Laudator Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick, and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Coming up today, Elgar's Nursery Suite, dedicated to two young princesses. When Albino Luciani wrote a letter to Charles Dickens. Part 2 in the Papal States and all that. And Why Bother Staying Catholic Despite It All is back with the saddest of stories. Well, thanks so much for joining me once again. I'd like to begin on a more joyful note then, a musical one. My choice to mark the 60th anniversary of the accession to the throne of Queen Elizabeth. That's with music historian Monsignor Philip Whittemore.
Have you ever suffered from a thing called writer's block? You've got a deadline for something you're meant to be writing. You sit at your desk and nothing comes. You stare at a blank piece of paper or an empty computer screen and you wonder how you're ever going to get started. It happens to composers too, and it often happened to that great English composer Sir Edward Elgar, especially towards the end of his life. When he was quite an old man, in 1931, someone made a really good suggestion. Why don't you compose something using odd bits of music you wrote when you were young? Ideas you never really developed at the time. Elgar gave it a try, and the result was his Nursery Suite, dedicated to two young princesses, Elizabeth and Margaret, and their mother. Elgar jotted down a few notes about each movement in the suite. The first one, he said, should call up memories of happy and peaceful awakenings. The music flows in a serene way. A fragment of a hymn tune is introduced, a hymn written for little children when the composer was a youth. Elgar was about 21 when he wrote this hymn tune back in 1878. He probably wrote it for St. George's Catholic Church in Worcester, where his father was organist at the time, and where he himself became organist 7 years later. It was during this part of his life that he wrote some lovely small-scale church music that can easily be sung by parish choirs today. Some of you may know his fine setting of the Ave Verum Corpus, written in 1887. But to go back to that hymn tune which the old man recalled from his youth, you remember he said he'd written it for children. And true enough, the words are an evening hymn written for children by Francis Stanfield. Hear thy children, gentle Jesus, while we breathe our evening prayer. Save us from all harm and danger. Take us neath thy sheltering care. Don't believe anyone who tells you children don't like singing quality music. But it's true that it takes a special gift to write well for children. Elgar certainly had it. Even as an old man, the idea of composing a children's piece using fragments he'd jotted down over 50 years earlier gave him a new inspiration. The first movement of the nursery suite is about waking up in the morning. The hymn tune comes in quietly at first, then towards the end it's repeated more loudly and it dies away to a peaceful close. The day has begun.
And warm thanks there to our music historian, Monsignor Philip Whitmore, who's currently working as an official at the Vatican's Secretariat of State. Moving on in the broadcast, I'd now like to mark the 200th birthday of Charles Dickens by bringing you this feature I put together for you. But watch the change of pace and, of course, tone. Charles Dickens' grave lies in Westminster Abbey, in Poets' Corner. Here, 2 centuries after his birth on the 7th of February 1812, he was remembered in a special way. But above all, this great English 19th century novelist has not gone out of print in people's hearts and minds. Not perhaps for the prayers he wrote, some of which focused around supplications on behalf of the poor, the sick, the destitute, but for the larger-than-life characters he invented. Among them, many children, from hungry orphan Oliver Twist to lonely little Nell. His hallmark humanity and compassion sometimes even crossed paths with our parables. For example, that of the prodigal son, which he once referred to as the most beautiful story ever told. But while 80 years ago G.K. Chesterton, another English novelist, proclaimed Dickens as almost Catholic, and others still claimed him as almost Marxist, what's certain is that his 200th birthday is something you cannot bar humbug. So I thought I'd remember him here with a little bit of humour by bringing you an extract from a series of imaginary letters John Paul I wrote before becoming Pope to the illustrious through the ages, the Illustrissimi. Among these, one to Charles Dickens. Let's listen.
Your books pleased me immensely because they are pervaded with a sense of love for the poor. Against them stand the oppressors whom you disgrace with your pen dipped in the genius of anger and irony. We are in one boat full of people. If we don't want to encounter serious turmoil, the rule is this: all for one and one for all. The whole world is a poorhouse and has such need of God.
I hope you enjoyed this little feature I put together for you. Of course, I'll be bringing you more on Charles Dickens in the course of this year. Meanwhile, I'd like you to step back in time and join Jesuit church historian Gerald Fogarty, who teaches at the University of Virginia in the United States. Last week, Professor Fogarty spoke to us of the breach of Porta Pia, which put an end to the Papal States. Today he picks up where he left off, speaking to us, among other things, of the Lateran Pax. To February 11th, 1929. We talk about the Roman question and the Lateran Pax, but there are different parts to that. Lateran Treaty, a Concordat, and a Third Pact, aren't there?
Yeah, it gets complicated. They overlap. A Concordat, for our English-speaking listeners, is important. There's never been a Concordat in an English-speaking country because of the British and American common law. You have the rights that are not restricted by going to court. Whereas in the Roman law tradition, which runs throughout Europe for the most part, you have the rights the state gives you. So therefore, a concordat was an agreement between the Holy See and the government to guarantee the rights of the church within a particular country. And almost every European nation does have a concordat. So therefore, that was one of the things that came in. The treaty was to end the Roman question. There would be an indemnification for what was lost and so forth, the land lost. And the Pope had never touched what had been set aside in the Law of Guarantees in 1872. So now there was a general indemnification. And then included in that was the freedom of communication with his bishops everywhere and also the right to the diplomatic corps and the right of cardinals, who at that time were given the rank of Prince of the Blood, by the way. They were considered to be royalty and to be treated as such. But thank God we've done
it
with. Yeah.
So anyway, this definitively put an end to the Roman question.
Yes, and what it meant was, by 1861, all of Italy was now united except for the city of Rome. The city of Rome still remained in the temporal control of the Pope, only because French troops had come to defend the Pope here. So therefore, that's why the end of the control over Rome, that's why it becomes the Roman question. Because after all, the Pope is the Bishop of Rome, and yet he never visited his own cathedral. From 1870, St.
John Lateran.
That's right. People, St. Peter's is not a cathedral. It is a major basilica, but the chair is not there. The chair, that is the cathedra, is actually St. John Lateran. And that's where the Pope had...
That's why he's called Bishop of Rome, the Pope.
That's right. And one of his many titles. So that was the significance that now the Roman question was settled with the Holy See recognizing that the Kingdom of Italy in 1929 now had control of the city of Rome, legally. And it brought about a regularization between the two entities.
So it was a rigid and rainy day, and a Mussolini for the Italian state, and Cardinal Gasparri for the Holy See, then it was.
Holy See. And then right after that, Gasparri resigned, and the new Secretary of State was Eugenio Pacelli, who later on became Pius XII. And we could talk about this at some other time, perhaps, but that also brought about a change in the attitude of the Holy See towards the United States. The Holy See regarded the United States in 1899 with great suspicion. Gradually, that starts to change because it was obvious that another war was going to come. And with that other war, the Holy See knew they would have to do something with the United States.
And Pius XII was the first to visit the United States, but not as Pope.
That's right. In 1936, the first Pope to come as Pope was Paul VI. But Pacelli came over in 1936, supposedly as the house guest of Mrs. Brady, who endowed a number of things around here. And the trip was taken over by this auxiliary bishop who was a close friend of Pacelli's who had worked in the Secretary of State. His name was Francis Spellman. He was auxiliary bishop of Boston. And he and Mrs. Brady had a major falling out because Bishop Spellman knew that Pacelli wanted to meet the president, Roosevelt. So how do you arrange this? And finally, it was done in 1936 through this subterfuge. You had the official hierarchical group working on it through the United States State Department, when all of a sudden Pacelli called the apostolic delegate, the papal representative, to the hierarchy. He said, don't worry, we have made arrangements through Monsignor Spellman. It was done through Joe Kennedy, the father of President John Kennedy. And the idea was that they would meet at the president's mother's house for lunch 2 days after his election to a second term. So it was not an official state visit. Because how did you arrange for the prime minister and foreign minister of an entity with which the United States does not have diplomatic relations to meet with the head of state? So that was the problem.
Going back to the Lateran Pax, of course, beyond that historic signing in 1929, there was a lot of behind-the-scenes work that went on towards that moment, long before that date, no?
In fact, the work for that began at the Treaty of Versailles in 1919. And there was this interesting priest,
American.
Yeah, Francis Kelly. And he became the Bishop of Oklahoma City later on. But he had in his diary or something how he talked to the foreign minister. And a lot of people thought this was phony until the actual signing of the pact where the foreign minister of Italy said the first step was taken by this American priest who could sort of be incognito to a great extent. Incidentally, the Lateran treaties did not end hostility between the Holy See and the government. By that time, the fascist government was in control of the government under the king, under the House of Savoy. But by 1931, there was great tension. The Concordat had been violated. So then there was an encyclical condemning fascism.
Pius XI's 1939 encyclical, Non Abbiamo Bisogno, on Catholic Action.
They couldn't publish it in the city because the fascists had shut down the Catholic presses, so it had to be smuggled out of Italy. And they gave it to this then Monsignor Spellman, who was working in the Secretariat of State, because as an American citizen, they weren't going to stop him. And he took it by train to Paris, where it was published by the Associated Press and United Press International, the first encyclical I know of that was not published under official church auspices, but under, you know, the regular journalistic outlets.
And did it get a lot of publicity?
It did, because it was clear then that the Pope was not at all sympathetic with fascism. He was willing to cooperate with them. 2 years later, he signed the Concordat with the Third Reich, with Hitler. And at that time, he made the comment he would sign a concordat with the devil if it meant he could preserve the rights of the church. There's a book done by a German scholar recently they called The Pope and the Devil, because picking up on that phrase. But the purpose of any concordat is to preserve the rights of the church and give it standing, give any dispute standing within international law.
And wasn't he criticized for that?
Oh, yeah, well, especially his Secretary of State. But after all, still, it was the Pope who is the one who authorized the negotiation and the signing of the concordat. But he was criticized because was this recognition of Hitler. Well, it had been under work from 1929, actually, because before Pacelli became Secretary of State, 1914, he was appointed as the nuncio to the Kingdom of Bavaria. And then with the new empire, with the Weimar Republic after 1919, then he became the nuncio also to the Weimar Republic. He was there for another 10 years, 1929, when he came back here to Rome. I say back here to Rome because he was Roman-born.
Pius XI found it hard to actually adapt to the new situation after the signing of the Lateran Pacts. He couldn't be persuaded to move out of the Vatican, but there were some exceptions, like the time he did go to Castelvandolfo, 1938.
Yes.
And there was a reason connected
Definitely a reason. Because Hitler was making a state visit to the city of Rome, and there was all this preparation, the Via Foro Imperiale. They just probably shoveled over all sorts of ruins to make this wide avenue. Everyone has seen it somewhere near the Colosseum into the
Piazza Venezia.
And it's probably under it where a lot of ruins.
Probably destroyed a lot of beautiful things.
Yeah.
Buildings and architectural
models. What the Pope did is normally he doesn't go out to Castel Gandolfo until July, although maybe they start going out earlier now because...
Depends on the popes. Different patterns.
Time he went out in May so that he would not be present. And they also closed the Vatican museums. And then there was debate as to whether or not Hitler would ask for an audience. He didn't. And what would the Pope respond if he did? Then there was a marvelous naval parade because they had to do that in Naples. So they took the train down with Hitler. And the United States naval attaché went down, and they had 90 Italian submarines that all came out in one mass flotilla, and they dove on one end of the harbor. And several minutes later, they all rose at the same time at the other end. And even our United States naval attaché was fascinated by this. For the display in the Piazza Venezia here, most of the ambassadors were not invited, and the United States was not invited, for instance. So the United States ambassador to the kingdom took a seat that he could get. He was getting to be elderly. And nevertheless, he described what happened because Mussolini was fascinated by the Nazi soldiers and their goose step. So he put in what they called the Passo Romano. It was goose stepping Italian troops. Didn't quite work. And a lot of comments in the newspapers because what they were used to was the Passo Italiano, which was much more freewheeling. The Italians cheered when that happened, when they saw it. And by the way, the Pope also had an audience for several hundred newly married couples at Castel Gandolfo, and he talked about what a crime it was that you had the cross of Christ overshadowed by the crooked cross, the swastika, and that this was a disgrace to the Italian nation as a Christian nation.
And our thanks there go to Father Gerald Fogarty, a church historian who teaches at the University of Virginia in the United States. Finally, to end the broadcast, why not listen to the latest in Monsignor Peter Fleetwood's reflections for the series Why Bother? Staying Catholic Despite It All. As you probably know if you listen frequently to our broadcasts, Monsignor Peter is currently serving as parish priest at St. Joseph's Blundellsands in the Liverpool Archdiocese in England. His reflection is inspired by the saddest of real-life episodes, which he decided to share with us. It's called Some Unexpected Gifts.
Priests working in parishes come across amazing situations and remarkable people. Recently, I came home from a trip to the Holy Land, where situations had taxed our understanding and tugged at our hearts. Two people from my parish kindly came to meet me and brought me back to my big, empty house. It was a Sunday evening, and as we passed the local library, they said that the coffee shop opposite the library had been the scene of much activity earlier that day, with three ambulances outside, apparently to attend to a sick baby. Thought no more about it, and went to bed very tired. The next morning, after Mass, I went to another church for the funeral of one of my fellow priests. It was an impressive and moving occasion. When I came home, I set about clearing emails. One of the hospital chaplains had written to me to tell me he'd baptized a 9-week-old boy from my parish, so I immediately wrote and thanked him. He replied within minutes to tell me the little boy had been transferred to a special unit, where he had later died. So I immediately went to see his parents, pretending to be brave, but really with my heart pounding. What are you supposed to say or do in situations like that? As it happened, the Holy Spirit was there with us. We spent a short time together that was full of tears but ended in calm. Let's call the baby Joseph, and his mother and father, Bernard and Pauline. For years, Bernard did a job that brought him in contact with violence, fear, and the sadness of having to inform people their relations had died. But the experience of losing his son had shaken him in a way he could never have imagined. Pauline was devastated, but did something quite remarkable, which surprised her and Bernard as much as me. She said little Joseph had brought a number of unexpected blessings in his short life. I asked her if she thought she would be able to write some of this down. She immediately said she would never be able to speak these words. And I said, I was thinking of something you might put on the order of service for Joseph's funeral. And her face changed. She and Bernard seemed to find peace in this idea. When we celebrated Joseph's funeral mass, we put chairs on the sanctuary and a table for the little white coffin in the centre. We were close to him and to each other. And I said there would be nothing spectacular during the service, but hopefully calm and dignity, which I think the Lord granted us. The final part of the Mass was excruciating for Pauline, and the short service of burial was like a sword piercing the hearts of so many people. But let me read you some of what Pauline wrote about her son. Joseph left behind a number of unexpected gifts. His grandmother said his death was the worst thing that could have happened, but that it happened in the best possible way. Joseph died on a beautiful winter's afternoon in a cafe that he visited with his mum many times during his short life. He slipped away in his mother's arms, full of milk, smelling his mother and listening to the voices of his parents. He was as close to the womb as it is possible to be. He allowed his father to do everything possible to try to save him. The hospital consultants told the family subsequently that Bernard's expert and quick reactions prolonged Joseph's life, enabling his family to say goodbye to him and reminding his mother that his father is an extraordinary man. Neither parent was left wondering whether there is more they could have done to help Joseph. His passing has brought their family closer together and strengthened and deepened the love his parents have for each other. He gave Bernard and Pauline the confidence to be good parents by taking away the fear Pauline had felt before he came along. The whole family has been amazed by people's response to Joseph's death. They felt tremendously supported, and from some unexpected quarters. He has reminded them what is important and what is not. Whilst Joseph's life was very short, it was perfect. He knew no pain, no fear, no anger, and no sorrow. Joseph knew only love and happiness. We will remember him for beautiful smiles, wonderful facial expressions, delightful baby noises, and early signs of a mischievous character. I don't know how Pauline managed to write this, but I'm so grateful she did. Pray for Joseph. Eternal rest grant to him, O Lord, and let perpetual light shine upon him. May he rest in peace.
And a big thank you there to Monsignor Peter Fleetwood, parish priest at St Joseph's Blundell Sands in the Liverpool Archdiocese in England. And that brings us up to time. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. Laudetur Jesus Christus.